Now, we're ready to move on to our last panel. And what do I say here? And I get to introduce the last panel. We know where you live, where you will live. Tom Maddox is a very, very old friend of mine. 25 years, I think I've known him. And he put this panel together.
I was a child, I should add.
He was a child, and still is. And I was childlike, but, or with child, maybe. But,
No,
that's a difference. Don't,
I can't believe
don't even do that. Anyway, we asked him and Pat Cadigan, Bruce, and Werner to be prepared to comment on the conference and whatever else they had on their minds, which basically means we have absolutely no idea what they're going to do next. But they have until 4:30 to do it, so you're on.
Thank you, Susan. I'm going to introduce my colleagues here, and then we're going to troop to the podium one by one and deliver ourselves a 15 minutes worth of whatever it is on people's minds, which we are all equally blissfully ignorant of. I am Tom Maddox. I'm a science fiction writer and sometime journalist and essayist and writing director at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. And to my right here and to your left is Pat Cadigan, author of Mind Players, Sinners, and Fools, the last two of which won the Arthur C. Clarke Award in England. And to her right, Werner Vinge, Associate Professor of Computer Science at San Diego State University, also a science fiction writer, author of True Names, Marooned in Real Time, Fire Up on the Deep. And to his right, or at the far end there, is Bruce Sterling, who's sort of taken up permanent residence today at this podium. Bruce is, and I'll let you guess where I got this description, a grizzled CFP veteran, if that rhetoric has a familiar ring to it, and a science fiction writer. We're going to go, first Pat is going to do her bit, then Werner, then I will do one, and finally Bruce. And we'll take questions afterward. We'll do about 15 minutes each. Pat?
That's right. I wrote books called Mind Players, Sinners, and Fools. I feel like I know y'all. I bet you feel like you know me, too. Thanks, everyone, for coming, and thanks even more for staying. And thanks for getting me involved. Thanks to everyone who managed to convince me to come here. It's been enlightening. I don't know a whole lot about this stuff to begin with, and I'm not sure exactly how much more I know, but I think I'm a little bit smarter now than I was when I came in. Well, I guess you'll be the judge of that. I was wondering how to talk about being unplugged in a real plugged-in conference like this. And because I'm, you know, kind of a unreconstructed hippie and you know, it's like plugged versus unplugged, and lots of hippies went on to be incredible tech heads, and others are still sort of out there growing brown rice by hand. But, you know, and I was thinking in terms of unplugged as being subversive, which for unreconstructed hippies is a real sort of a thing that has a positive kind of a connotation to it. But, you know, not always, because on the one hand, you know, it's terribly nice to be, you know, organic and natural and out there in the air and everything, and it's on the other hand, it's terribly inconvenient not to have a telephone. But I was thinking about a lot of the issues here, and I was particularly fascinated during the first day of the conference with the moot court and the people talking and everything, and I was listening to poor Mr. Nelson, Dr. Clipper, talk about how if the government didn't have access to certain kinds of information or to a whole lot of information, that there would be more incidents like the World Trade Center bombing and the Oklahoma City bombing. And I had several realizations at once when he said that. And one was that, you know, I've always really felt, without necessarily articulating it, that information without context is really just noise. And another was that people who work in those areas in Washington, D.C., like people in Hollywood, really don't have a clue, you know, about life as she has lived away from the bright lights and the fame, you know. These are not people who shop at Safeway. I mean, not personally. Now, Ms. Nelson made the statement on Thursday about, you know, needing the information, you know. And he also noted that one of the alleged perpetrators of the Oklahoma City bombing wasn't really very bright because he was speeding out of town at 85 miles per hour in a truck with no license plate. Now, Mr. Nelson has obviously grown up in more civilized areas of the world. I've lived in Kansas for 23 years, and I've been to Oklahoma many times. And this is not necessarily unusual behavior in Oklahoma. The man himself was encrypted. I mean, do you think this is the first time he went 85 miles per hour in an unlicensed truck? Don't ask me how he got stopped. He might never have been stopped. And I don't know about around here, but out there in the Oklahoma neighborhood, people thought at first that the Oklahoma City bombing had been perpetrated by terrorists, you know, foreign terrorists, foreign Arab terrorists. I know, I sound like I'm perpetrating a stereotype here, but I've lived for 23 years out there, and there are people who say Arab. Pardon? Oh, okay. Oh, more Midwesterners out there? But, you know, I knew better about the terrorist thing. I always know better, in case you're wondering. Because I have lived in that area for 23 years, and that's less than a day's drive from the Ozarks, which is an area of the country which has already been identified as a place where white supremacists hang out and get drunk and plot to blow things up. And I knew it just had to be someone from that area of society, because foreign terrorists go for things like the World Trade Center, you know, and heavy areas on the east or west coast. Only a white supremacist would think that blowing up a building in Oklahoma City would be striking a blow against what they call the Zionist occupational government. You need a narrow worldview to think like that. But I'm not really making jokes about a lot of people getting killed. And I'm not even going to go on about how it was a terrible tragedy, and gosh, I'd do anything to prevent a tragedy like that, unless, of course, it violated too many people's civil rights. Or wonder how many people's civil rights it would be okay to violate to stop someone like Timothy McVeigh. We could go round and round about that. And with the people in this room, I could hear a whole lot of arguments on either side of that question, and they'd all be incredibly intelligent and something to keep me awake at night. But I'm tired and I need my sleep. And I got to tell you, the issue just really isn't that simple. Now, it is absolutely true that white supremacists have been actually among the first of the grassroots type of people to embrace electronic bulletin boards and email and all the rest of that stuff. But the government, or anyone else, could have monitored those boards and even violated the email transmissions, and no one would have found out what Timothy McVeigh was up to. McVeigh was flying under the radar. Well, except for the police radar. You know, he wasn't even flying. And in the end, while the governments are chasing highly sophisticated code keys in rarefied areas of cyberspace, some guy is going to drive into town in a pickup truck full of smelly old fertilizer and blow up the mainframe. Now, I'm not denying that computer crime exists, and I'm not denying that computers can be used to facilitate a real-time crime. I'm saying that we're missing the point about both the uses and abuses of computers, law enforcement, and so forth. I mean, well, I'm not as worried about having to register my PGP key. In fact, I'm not even real sure what it is. That's like admitting, you know, in this crowd, that's like admitting I don't know how to use the telephone, you know. But, I mean, I get email from people, and there's this thing of numbers, you know, numbers and letters and symbols, and it says, finger me at wherever for my PGP key. And first of all, because I don't know how this works, I don't understand why I should finger this person for a PGP key if it's supposed to be encrypted and I'm not supposed to know what it says. But the other thing is that, you know, I can imagine what Timothy McVeigh or someone like him would say, hey, where do we finger you for your PGP key? You know, is that a straight line or what? Now, what I and some of my colleagues are really more concerned with about, you know, in terms of the privacy issue, is probably best expressed by that unforgettable phrase in the Miranda warning. Everything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. But furthermore, I would add that everything said about you can and will be used against you in any and every way anyone can come up with. If you think I'm paranoid now, you've seen me before I got my lithium prescription. Perhaps, maybe when you grow up as a woman, though, you understand this last part better. And I'm not talking about gossip. I'm talking about what I think of as homebrew semiotics. You know, the women in the audience will understand what I'm talking about. Don't wear too much makeup. They'll think you're easy. Don't act too smart. You'll scare off the boys. You know. And then later on, it's dress for success. You know. Dress for success. You know, and that has been more of an issue for women than it has been for men. In fact, if men had to take all of the instructions women do about their appearances, you know, there'd be a major overthrow of everything in the world, I think. But this sort of homebrew semiotics has an impact on all of us, you know, in a way. Because someone somewhere came up with the idea of grouping people by commonalities, you know, for the purpose, it's for a lot of purposes. But some of those purposes weren't so good. And so, consequently, we had a need for the 22nd Amendment, so that when you strut down the street in your Slaves of Satan denim vest, the police can't haul you in just for being a card-carrying biker, or a Crip, or a Blood, or an MIT grad student. However, Direct Marketing Incorporated can put you in their database as a Harley rider and target you for mailings of the Harley-Davidson accessories catalog. And someone can notice that statistically, Harley riders do tend to comprise a higher percentage of smokers who are also meat eaters. And so Harley-Davidson cigarettes will send you coupons in the same envelope with Oscar Mayer's. And someone will regroup that group as being statistically likely to support the interests of the tobacco industry, and people like that will generally vote Republican, according to another database that has already been organized on the basis of several preceding assumptions. So now I've conjured a stereotype of a chopper-riding, cigarette-smoking, right-wing thug, and he's hated by a whole lot of people who never even met him. But that's marketing for you, and it's not infallible. I got on the religious right mailing list once, and I'm not even sure how it happened. But that was embarrassing. But it wasn't quite as substantive as the high car insurance rates I had to pay back when I was an under 25 driver. Of course, the car accessories catalog people found me because in their database, under 25 drivers are more likely to buy sheepskin car seat covers. And I don't know why they think this, because when I was an under 25 driver, my premiums were so high, I couldn't afford to buy fuzzy dice. But we all know that it's natural and often useful and even sometimes wise to draw conclusions from what people are drawn to in terms of their affinities, that old birds of a feather effect. And when someone doesn't do the grouping for us, we group ourselves. We come to things like this. Or we list our particular choice of links on our web pages. And anyone can browse the web and make their own list of links from that. And if you had enough time and enough budget and enough perspicacity, you could probably distill people down to a list of links. You could probably distill yourself. Which sounds terribly unnatural. If you can, well, then somebody else can and probably will. And it might be someone, with a reformer zeal, someone who decides to devote time and effort to reducing health costs, which is a very, you know, noble idea. Lower insurance rates for non-smokers is already a reality in a lot of companies, but that's not so bad. Everyone hates smokers, right? But then there's the question of secondhand smoke, and that's a real issue. So you have a non-smoking spouse with higher insurance rates. Well, spouses can do whatever they want, and if their spouses don't love them enough to get them lower insurance rates by quitting, then that's their lookout, right? So what about their children? If a child becomes identified as a member of a high-risk group, what happens to that child, and what happens to that child's development in a society like ours? But let's say, for example, that all of us are databased 19 to the dozen. In fact, we don't actually even know how much we're databased. Okay, all right, maybe you guys do, but people like me really don't. A few years back, I was working as an order taker for the Disney catalog. The world headquarters of the Disney catalog happens to be about a mile from my house in Overland Park, Kansas. And it's very well encrypted. No one would look for it there. And I can tell you with absolute certainty that if you have ever called the Disney catalog and ordered something with your credit card, your name, address, credit card number are all still available for the order takers to look up. And not just the Disney catalog, but the catalogs that you don't know are owned by the Disney catalog, but don't share the same phone number, but do share the same order takers. But when you call the Disney catalog or the other catalogs again and again, they're not going to tell you that. They're going to act like they never heard of you. So, and you're not going to know this, you know, unless you work there and listen to me tell you about it. So this is just a relatively narrow example of how much is on record. And of course, it's just the tip of the iceberg for everyone. Now, say all of this knowledge could be coupled with the desire to save the world from itself, and that gets applied to even more than it is already. Now, it is possible, by way of pharmacy inventory records, banking records, grocery store records, consumer databases, motor vehicle bureau, voter registration, Disney catalog, insurance tables, records of premiums, job histories, not just of you, but of your family, spouses, kids, parents, and their families. All of this could give you what I think of as an electronic fingerprint or retina scan or voice pattern, uniquely yours and very exploitable. For example, wanting to reduce the risk of stroke in certain portions of the population who would seem prone to it by way of, say, genetics, eating habits, vices, etc., is a very noble intention, isn't it? But only some people are at risk, and of these people, the risk isn't uniform. Some are at greater risk and some are at less. So when you're thinking about that, keep in mind that also there are a variety of elements that contribute to the risk, depending on the individual, and all this databasing has led to a solution of how to encourage good stroke risk lessening behavior and discourage bad practices. And the solution is, in this hypothetical example, rather than make everyone pay a high sort of sin tax on items that could contribute to stroke in some people, you use the databases to impose a point of sale surcharge on certain items of for certain individuals. So you could end up with the following scenario. My lovely assistant will help me with this. We have a little drama here. Okay? My lovely assistant Tom goes to the store and the checkout lady says to him, "Are you ready to check out?"
"Yes. I have here a box of iodized salt, a half gallon of frozen Cherry Garcia yogurt, two cans of Kalamata olives, a package of chicken thighs, two cans of mixed nuts, a pound of carrots, a bag of celery, and a half pint of ranch dip. And here are some coupons. You guys still give double coupons, right?"
"Yes, we certainly do. Will there be anything else?"
"Oh, I almost forgot. A case of Amstel Light."
Okay, with the amounts for the coupons taken off and then the tax, that comes to $165.47.
"Holy Christ, lady, what are you talking about?"
"That's $165.
I heard you. This is ridiculous. Your prices are outrageous."
"Not at all, sir. Our prices are quite competitive. Here's the receipt."
"Wait a minute. It says here that I paid over $100 in taxes."
"Looks that way."
But why?"
"Apparently, you have been charged for the risk to your health incurred by purchase of certain items. The fees will offset the cost of your future hospitalization."
But the tax here isn't itemized. It's just this lump sum."
"That's correct, sir. My machine does not itemize."
"But so you can't even tell me what I'm being taxed on, and so
No, sir, I'm not allowed to know.
But why not?
Well, that would be a violation of the privacy of your medical records.
But let me explain. This is for a party my wife is giving, except for the yogurt. My kids will eat the yogurt.
Well, next time send one of them into the store. They've got a longer life expectancy. You could possibly realize a savings.
Could realize, possibly?
Well, that's what I've heard, anyway. Thank you, Tom. My lovely assistant. I think Mel Gibson better watch out. Okay, now if you think that's strange and unlikely, I don't think you've been paying attention for the last 30 years. Run down the marketing department of whatever company you work for and call up a composite profile from the market segments group, or check out if there's an entry for Nixon's enemies list on the Encarta disk. Now, the considered application of information gathered hither and yon may well have the desired effect of identifying people who are members of a group likely to advocate the use of terrorism and violence. But it's like I said before, while the government is chasing around in cyberspace, some guy in a pickup truck is going to drive into town and blow up the mainframe. And this is because the government, and now I have to say the government is we the people. We keep confusing information and knowledge. You can't gather knowledge. Knowledge is applied information, and one of the first things to know is that just because you have a lot of information doesn't mean you have any knowledge at all. We, the people, the government, could have tapped every phone in Oklahoma, but we still would not know the demons that would tell a man to park a bomb next to a building full of kids in the daycare center. People who do things like that may well not have a telephone at all, not a cellular, not even a rotary dial. The erroneous assumption here, and it's one that we too often work from, is that improved surveillance and intelligence gathering can provide greater and greater and greater protection. And I'm sure that there are good people who honestly and sincerely believe this. But I tell you three times, it just ain't necessarily so. The great lie that we keep telling ourselves is that we can prevent anything we want to prevent. We can't, and we will never be able to. I do concede that we can use gathered information to make life better or safer or nicer or prettier or more fun or whatever. But only if we know how to turn information into knowledge. Information is not going to do anyone any good if your heart's in the right place and your head's up your ass. Information is just information, and it's knowledge that is power. And information, a whole lot of information, is really none of our business. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. Werner, you're up next.
Well, thanks, Tom. There was virtually no substantive collaboration about content between the members of this panel, so I'm surprised that there actually is a segue here, and what Pat has to say actually does have some feed into what I'm going to say.
Oops.
Backwards. I know. It's not a transparency. Is that legible? Different people over time have had different views about the ultimate impact of computing on human freedom. What have I done to it?
Ooh.
Hey!
Oh!
Thank you,
cool.
Thank you.
It's MIT.
And in my simplistic way, I reduce this to a one-dimensional spectrum of opinion about the impact of computing on human freedom. And if you look at this century, up to the time of the personal computers, I would say to the extent that people thought about it at all, that they regarded computers as a major threat toward human liberty. In other words, the George Orwell opinion. And then as you get into the 80s and the personal computers, there certainly are a lot of people who think that if millions of ordinary citizens have computers that are even somewhat powerful, that it is the end of the nation state. I think that law enforcement has lots of reasons to be anxious about the sort of power that is present on networks and machines in the hands of lots of people. But I think also that there are possibilities for law enforcement that actually lead to greater levels of control beyond George Orwell's wildest imagination. And as far as this spectrum goes of how it's ultimately going to come down for human freedom, I think that that jury is very much still out. And what I want to talk about today is a use of technology that would actually push the final resolution very far toward the George Orwell end of the spectrum. And furthermore, it's a use of technology that has many attractive features. I mean, attractive features to ordinary people. This technology is essentially fine-grained distributed systems. The example in the supermarket actually illustrates that sort of thing, although not pushed to the limit of a fine-grained distributed system. In a supermarket with such a system, you have essentially CPUs on each price label, or perhaps on each priced object, and that these are networked, and that you have a way of tracking everything. Fine-grained distributed systems have marvelous, almost a magical potential for turning the world into a much safer and much more profitable place. Should note that this is actually far beyond the level of networking that we talk about nowadays with the web and such. This is actually extending the network way down, and in extreme cases you have embedded systems at a very low level that are part of the network. And it may not work. I mean, there's the people who are very optimistic about fine-grained distributed systems are very enthusiastic about it. Well, I believe that the awesome potential of fine-grained distributed systems also exists for law enforcement. And I made up a name for this. The use of fine-grained distributed systems in connection with law enforcement, call it ubiquitous law enforcement. ULE. I usually call it ULE if I'm going to abbreviate it, although as acronyms go, it can also be pronounced. This technology could be implemented by mandating, by government mandating, of government-designed chips on each communications node, meaning one chip. That's a limited, a bounded requirement, one chip on each communications node, together with laws imposing significant penalties for trying to circumvent the logic on those chips or on the attendant programs. In fact, the idea could probably be applied more generally to small embedded systems by mandating a new style of microcontroller. In this diagram, which I want to rush to assure you is completely fictional and hypothetical. I'm not claiming Motorola is doing anything like this. But there is actually a certain reason for this particular hypothetical version of it, and that is the microcontrol, the Motorola 68300 microcontroller series is very interesting in that it's very widespread through embedded systems around the world. And it also is one that customers can mix and match the functional units within the chip. So in this one, we have the usual standards you'd find in some types of communications microcontrollers. You have the arithmetic and logic unit, registers, DMA, serial ports, Ethernet controller, various memory. And then this area down here is the government mandated portion of the microcontroller chip. And I've written in pencil that there are things inside that. I've deliberately written in pencil so you can't see very clearly what they are. But there presumably is RAM in there, and there is an arithmetic and logic unit, and there's also some other stuff that I marked with question marks. I think a very interesting thing about this sort of approach is once, or more importantly, it was generally accepted that a certain fixed percentage of silicon real estate on each node must be dedicated to protecting the public safety. Once that is established, then a significant power of this concept is that it becomes more powerful with each new generation of hardware, because you are actually reserving a certain amount of area on the chip, not a certain number of gates. Once this sort of thing were in place, and I don't necessarily mean the true ubiquity, but pervasively in place, how would it be used? Well, one way of using it would be in support of government-mandated algorithms and software. And I think the Pamela Samuelson's panel yesterday about smart copyright is certainly an example where this sort of thing could lend considerable strength. But it really goes much beyond that, because such a mandated development in hardware allows extremely, extremely flexible enforcement. And in fact, the term enforcement is really kind of a misnomer here, because it goes beyond the narrow meaning of enforcement. Of course, it could cover things like surveillance, census-type information gathering, but it also includes things that haven't been perhaps considered before, and that is simple routine day-to-day regulation in support of legislation and of bureaucratic rules about how things are supposed to be done. In fact, in an extreme case, especially if all the hype about an information economy really takes off, it allows one of the most pervasive forms of a VAT. You might want to call it a bit tax rather than a value-added tax, but that the tax is actually being collected at the communications nodes, and most importantly of all, from the standpoint of selling such ideas, is that it's totally transparent to the user, except maybe when he looks at his bank account, you know, from month to month. This idea I originally got from reading one of Pamela Samuelson's early articles about the smart copyright stuff, which certainly does not include the idea of real hardware as far as I know. But it sort of made me think about this sort of thing, and I bounced the idea off a number of friends of mine who are actually quite reasonable people, and actually they liked it. And the reason they liked it is that it makes the needs of government and the paperwork that is associated with meeting the needs of government much less intrusive in time and upon the consciousness of the average citizen. Now, This makes me think that it actually is possible that ubiquitous law enforcement, with a much more smiling face than I have presented it, may actually become kind of a persistent background noise in certain sorts of initiatives. Now, I'll bet that most of the people here, in reaction to this idea, think that, first of all, the basic installation of such a system is unworkable, and secondly, if it were workable, it would be monstrous. I want to respond to the unworkability, and at the same time give, to me, a couple big reasons why this is a monstrous idea. The first big downside is that this hardware is supporting software that would also be part of various regulatory systems, and the laws that would be necessary to prevent and penalize people for hacking the software and the hardware would be extraordinarily hard to enforce. They would be like drug laws. So one outcome of this for the people who might think that this would be less intrusive is you do wind up with a kind of drug wars 2 situation, which from some standpoints actually has certain sorts of benefits, but on balance from the standpoint of the average citizen, it's pretty obnoxious. The other thing about this idea is its very flexibility. In fact, it's bringing the flexibility of the general purpose computer down to a very fine-grained level, general purpose program computer. This means that dictatorships just taking this, if it were ever off the shelf and widely accepted, and making their networks over in its form could impose extreme forms of very close regulation on their populations. At the same time, if this sort of stuff was ever in place, even the most mild-mannered and benevolent government that was just using this to make sure, make it possible for citizens not have to worry about paperwork so much and generally smooth the application of regulations, even in such a relatively utopian situation, because these are programmed devices, if there were a national emergency, the situation could be turned around into a very strongly totalitarian system on a time scale that would be far shorter than any historical precedent. Thank you.
What a wonderful machine this is. Its name, by the way, is Elmo. I don't know if you can see that from the audience. That I find that very endearing. It's called Elmo, and it has two modes, one not so good and one good. When I was on the way here and thinking about coming here, I must confess, with a number of presuppositions. I'll try to unpack a few, because I want to make clear that this is what I'm going to give you is an intensely subjective report on what I saw here the past few days. As they say on the net, your mileage may vary, and I expect that it will. But I came in with a couple of presuppositions, and one is that the two groups that would be present here in force, as it were, would be the regulators and the marketers, or roughly speaking, those who want to govern us and those who want to sell things to us, presuming that you can tell the two apart. Also, there's a third force here, with the academic contingent, and then I had this curiously naive notion that there would be yet another group, which would be us, and that we would speak here. And I have seen here a pervasive, all-encompassing kind of dominance of the regulators and, to a lesser extent, the marketers. And so, in a sense, if I'm unbalanced or even perhaps could be construed as gnawing the hand that has feed me, maybe I'm just trying to redress that balance a little bit. Because what I saw here over and over in panels was the government saying, trust me, and the people who wanted to do business saying, we will provide the driving wheel for all of it, that the money is what makes it happen. the role of the academics in this, and I have, this is not a well-considered thought, but it's something that occurred to me, seems to be the grease that fits in between these two huge mechanisms where they join. You've got these great turning machines, and where the cogs grind into one another, then the academics, in this rather uncomfortable position, are the grease. Now, the question, of course, that comes to mind, I think, is what the hell are the rest of us doing here? And that's a question I want to lay on the table with some sort of promise that I'll say something about it at the end. I have unwieldy pieces of paper because I didn't trust the batteries on my laptop. now, so I guess what I want to say, by way of introduction, is I think this could have been called the Conference for Computers, Regulation, and Commerce. Okay. Business provides the driving wheel, government the flywheel on the driving wheel, if I haven't mixed my things mechanically there. And so what I want to do, first of all, is give you some words and images that I've gathered over the past few days from sitting in on these sessions, though there was at least one that I fled screaming into the hall on, and so didn't get much out of it. But most of them were actually extremely enlightening, if sometimes a bit difficult. Hal Abelson, when he began, said that cyberspace was a wretched word, and he also said that it was dead. It's not clear to me in what sense it's dead. I think I would like to say that. It's a very ambiguous assertion, and I'm also not clear that cyberspace is a wretched word. All words that are used that much become an annoyance. Right, you hear the word over and over and you say, oh God, can't you call it Bob or something, you know, but no, we can't. We have to, as T.S. Eliot said, I have to use words when I talk to you. And we need a word for this thing that we call cyberspace, and people would say, oh yes, it's wretched. No, by the way, in cyberspace, blah, blah, right. And I don't think it's at all dead, and I think the fact that it's overrun with the rabble is utterly wonderful. And Sander Van Oker, to the contrary, and very much Mike Godwin, I would like to support his statement, it is this Tower of Babel to which we must commit ourselves. And I'm, okay, I know. I know, and I didn't hear anybody even saying that much. What I heard them was worrying about what the rabble are going to do, but the truth is that the net at this point is the voice, is the vox populi. And if you don't like what the voice is saying, well, tough shit. Kind of, I think, because the people, for the first time in human history, so far as I know, have a pulpit. Generally not one with Hyatt on the front of it, right? But it does have a web in front of it, yes. And so I think that cyberspace is anything but dead. I think that the outrageous, unwashed, anarchistic, problematic, troublesome, obscene, semi-criminal and otherwise irritating aspects of it are part of the package. We are human beings, thank God, not consumers or not merely citizens. Certainly not orderly citizens who do as we're told. In another speech I heard, and I thought this was a very wise thing to say, governments want to be governments. You bet they do. But we don't necessarily want to collaborate's a nice word, don't you think? Word that has a certain historical resonance. We don't always want to collaborate with what the governments want to do. And in the same speech, the speaker said that he referred to a bag of sugar in a bathtub, which I think might be a motto for a web page, because cryptography, which seems to be so largely frightening to so many people, is at the bag of sugar in a bathtub stage, and we can all cook up something to drink anytime we want to. And I think that's extremely important. Same speaker also said that trusted third parties, TTPs, there's a phrase I learned to savor in the past few days, that they balance the interest of business and government. Well, how good of them, you know. I mean, really. Oh, Lord, yes. And then from the panel that I subtitled in my own mind, the Lackeys of the Ruling Class panel, though I don't believe it was listed as such, We were given the assurance that our government could be trusted with everyone's escrow keys because, and I believe this is a quote, they have never worked with other governments to the detriment of their citizens. Yeah. There were cries of China, Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Chile in the audience, right? You know, and I don't know. That's very interesting. The same thing that I believe it was the same person who assured us that the government pays attention to individuals, quote, because they vote. Well, that's not going to make me sleep well tonight. Let's put it that way. A, because apparently he hasn't noticed that most of us don't in this country. You know, that we view the prospect apparently with ever increasing apathy. And second, that the way the government deals with us as voters varies from mildly alarming to utterly contemptible, I think, would be something on the spectrum. So that I didn't find that very reassuring. I also, same person said that strong cryptography means necessary loss of life and a rise in domestic crime, thus invoking what a rude cypherpunk called the five horsemen of the information age apocalypse, right? Yes, the cypherpunks in the back with their cries through the time have punctuated this. You know, I hope I get the five horsemen right. They are terrorists, child pornographers, money launderers, drug dealers, and nuclear terrorists, I believe, are the five. And that they will take over, right? So I found that panel extremely interesting, followed as it was by the gentleman from Shell, who played very fairly with us, I thought. He was an extremely lucid and convincing person and announced his allegiances and the allegiance of his corporation, though not being the person who was concerned with these matters, he did not mention words like Nigeria. And the notion of what petroleum countries this century and the previous century, for that matter, have done to the sovereignty of local countries and to the cultures of small groups. But I found that all very interesting. And again, it's the purest example that I saw of this government business axis in operation. I've mentioned Sander van Oker and his Tower of Babel. What else were we there? Oh, yes, I did want to mention the fact that, as Marshall McLuhan quoted James Joyce from Finnegan's Wake, here comes everybody, that is what this is really all about, and all their attempts to legislate it or to stuff it back into the bottle simply aren't going to work. On that mass media panel, I don't remember anyone addressing the utter vacuity, the inestimable vacuity of the television medium, the empty, disturbing lack of anything like real news that we see when we turn on the television. I don't remember Mr. Van Oker feeling that was necessary to talk about. And I don't know, I sort of feel that it is. And as with the public schools, I feel that anything that replaces it would be all right. There was also, among many panelists, a recognition of the fundamental divergence between us and them. There were repeated references by government representatives, I started to say government agents, I don't know why, that there was hostility out here in the audience. They presumed it coming in, they were resentful that it existed, and they sort of went back and forth between saying, well, I knew you were going to be a hostile audience, and issuing mild, veiled threats, you know, about one that I can recall was the notion that there would be a future of unregulated cryptography. That won't happen, I believe was the phrase. Or it won't happen anywhere he's looking, you know. yes. So, but again and again they say, trust us. And, oh dear, some children just walked in. I was about to use a very rude phrase.
it's okay, they're Maggie.
I was going to, here's, yes, but I was, right. I beg your pardon, Mike?
You can still use those words.
That's right. In this medium, I can still use these words. Okay, I wanted to make a point about them, which is this. Now, anyone here who I'm going to make this point first. Anyone here who feels that rude language violates decorum or that it simply is has no place in this kind of gathering, I'm going to give you a couple of seconds to leave. Now the rest of you, I see you're just vulgar slime like myself. I want to tell you what the government is saying, and because I think that we need metaphors to live by. I'm a writer, you know. And what they're saying is, look, I just want to get it in an inch. I won't fuck you. And that's perhaps a reasonable proposition. I don't know. Moving on. Yes. I have some contrary conclusions to those drawn by many of the people whom I heard speaking. And I'll give them to you fairly quickly, which is, first, we are threatened primarily by governments and corporations, not by individuals. That we are threatened by the regulation of speech, not by its exercise, and that we are threatened by controls on cryptography, not by cryptography itself. I also would like to submit, though, as in line with what Pat said and in line with what Werner said, that I don't believe that cryptography is itself the major issue with regard to privacy. I think that the accumulation of data about us by corporations and by governments who have access to each other's data and allow us none, that is the real privacy issue. And that cryptography can be a weapon against that, but that cryptography by itself, as the gentleman from Shell said, is no protection. Right. Susan, do you? She wants to write down. She says, I have to kill myself or, okay, no. Sorry, wrong side. Somebody here has to kill himself. No. Okay, we must be out of the room before 4:45. No time for questions in this room. Okay, I'm gonna be done here in just 2 minutes, then Bruce will go and we'll do what we can. We'll float into the lobby if need be, I suppose, and take questions. I certainly would be willing to. Okay, the net, the web, the whole business, what Hal Abelson said, it's not just game space, it's the communications fabric of the world. Well, it is that, but it is also game space. And it is also a place for cyber sex, and it is also a place for chat rooms, and it's also a place to plot the overthrow of the U.S. government, and it's also a place to gather jokes, and it's also a place to do everything that we do as human beings, except in a different way. And the people who would regulate us wish that we wouldn't, right, but we will. And the people who would sell things to us wish that it could all be metered, but it can't. And I would say that we should all stand up and cheer every time we hear of a major corporate website failing, right? And just say, oh, Warner Pathfinder, oh, that's too bad. You know? And so that's why I think we're really here, because despite the fact that there are all these policy implications and there are all of these opportunities, no doubt, for future McVeighs to plot incredibly dire crimes due to the existence of PGP that wouldn't have been possible otherwise, or that I don't know what, some steely-jawed FBI agent will be able to rush in and whip the keys out of the pickup in the nick of time because he was able to crack their communications. I'm a science fiction writer. I'm telling you, I couldn't come up with a plausible scenario for that one. I just can't, you know, because I don't think you can. But despite all that, we're going to return here, and we're going to return to the Internet and to the Matrix, to use William Gibson's and John Quarterman's phrase, again and again, because it does give us these other things, these chances to, as Marshall McLuhan said, extend our humanity. And I think that's just utterly marvelous, and I've been glad to be here watching people do it and to listen to those other folks who don't want us to. Thank you very much.
Well, it's falling to me to be the last to speak, and I know you've suffered. rather than try and put any kind of rhetorical summary to the conference, I want to take this chance to turn our eyes to the future. And in order to speculate seriously, it's vital to understand the trends. To judge the future, we have to understand just how far we as a society have already advanced along a particular arc of development. Now, you can make that arc visible by imagining alternate possibilities, the possibilities which have failed. And let me see if I can demonstrate that arc of development to you in a concrete way. I want you to join me here in a little science fictional thought experiment. Let's briefly explore an alternate 1996, a world that is veered away from our own in a way that not very long ago seemed extremely plausible but did not actually come to pass. Now try to imagine all the many, many times that you have seen and heard the term internet during this conference. Now just take the term internet out, find and replace function, and insert the word prodigy. Let's listen to some of the dialogue we might overhear from that world, that alternate 1996. Just try to imagine overhearing some of these typical comments from your friends, coworkers, colleagues here at CFP6. You know, I got some prodigy mail from my 70-year-old dad yesterday. He says even mom's going to log on to prodigy. Mom never cared much about computers before, but she's really thrilled about the discussion groups and the prodigy chat. Gosh, Professor, I see you have a prodigy address printed on your new business card. Why, so do I. Yeah, I don't know how I managed before I got into prodigy. I'd rather lose my fax machine than lose my prodigy account. You know, it certainly is becoming a small world here at the end of the 20th century. Did you know that prodigy is in 167 countries now? I hear the Chinese are trying to regulate prodigy. The Germans just shut down 200 prodigy news groups. Even the Zambians are worried about political embarrassments from prodigy. You know, I've been covering the computer scene since the 80s, but now my newspaper just got its own prodigy page. As a journalist, I couldn't be more proud. You know, at last, management's finally coming away to my way of thinking. Did you know that there are over 500 new prodigy pages appearing every day around the world? These newspapers, bookstores, florist shops, universities, well, they all have these graphic prodigy pages now. Well, the first time this year, prodigy traffic on the telephone networks has become bigger than voice traffic. That dialogue sounds amazing, I think. It's weird and it's shocking, but, you know, just a few years ago, that prospect seemed extremely probable. IBM, a computer company, global multinational that could do no wrong, and an alliance with Sears, one of the world's oldest and most respected marketing companies, unbelievable technical power combined with unmatched marketing savvy. What on earth could hinder such a colossus? And with a budget of $900 million. You know, on the internet, by stark contrast to this obscure gaggle of wacky academics and programming nerds, and Prodigy had a well-thought-out business plan and a budget and a staff, you'd sure never find that on the internet. You see, Prodigy offered every single thing that people always pretend that they want from an information network. No troublesome pornography, no annoying or harassing messages from distant strangers, no intellectual piracy, no software scams, no indecency, no offensive fanatical harangues, hackers kept well at bay, professional network experts running professional centralized machines that would respond predictably for users, hired talent of a professional caliber providing most of the content, a well-regulated marketplace on the computer screen, a safe place for children, simple, colorful, user-friendly interfaces that even a grandmother could use, low rates, a controlled, gated, suburban virtual community, a place that was legal and accountable where the authorities are always visibly present, and there's always somebody convenient to sue. Well, that was Prodigy's version of reality before they decided to sell internet access instead in a desperate final attempt to look hip and with it. And that vision is still what the United States Congress pretends to want from online activity. And it's certainly the only form of online activity that the American Christian right is prepared to grudgingly tolerate. So why is the buzzword internet instead of Prodigy? It wasn't because of a conscious decision or a dirigiste government mandate or a democratic vote. People just voted with their feet. Because internet better suits the tenor of the times. Internet, this headless bread mold of a network, is a symptom and an avatar and a metaphor of a deeper social process. You know, if you don't know the past, you can't really envision the future. So let's take a little imaginary trip into the past this time. Let's say the year 1976. Not so long ago, a recognizable cultural landscape, a lot of the same major players, Republicans, Democrats, AT&T, Shell Oil. And imagine yourself appearing via time machine in the office of a corporate futurist in 1976. You know, quite a lot of corporations actually employed futurists in those days because America in 1976 was still a rather forward-looking society where major corporations employed doers and builders and dreamers rather than trimmers, slashers, and bean counters. So you go into this guy's office and you give him the skinny about the forthcoming trends in 1996. Maybe you lean over and you whisper to him the fatal word, globalization. Twilight of national sovereignty. And our corporate futurist from 1976, he's getting all clued in. He's nodding eagerly. He says, oh yeah, we've seen that trend coming for years. That's all right. We're multinationals. We can live with globalization. We can thrive through that. Never mind that loss of authority by mere national governments. What about us multinational enterprises? And you tell him, suddenly you're all like the ghost of Christmas future. You tell him, downsizing, outsourcing, collapse of the corporate hierarchy, abolition of lifetime employment, mass firings of middle management, virtual corporations, everything devolved into a viral mess of road warriors with laptops. The gray flannel warrior, Mr. Organization Man, just dwindling like the bison. Who the hell did that? He demands in visible agitation. Who destroyed the modern capitalist order? Was it communists? Was there a nuclear exchange? No. You did it all to yourselves. You did it all on purpose. You made that choice. You thought it was a good idea. It was corporate anorexia. You came to see your own loyal employees as useless fat. And then you go on to explain to them that the American federal government in 1996 is shut down three times because the president and Congress couldn't be bothered to pass a budget. And he just throws you out of the office at that point. He can't believe that. He might possibly believe that the almighty Soviet Union could collapse without a shot being fired, but he'd never believe that the U.S. Congress and administration would engage in the shenanigans of a banana republic. But we do live in 1996, and that is what's happening. Across the board, we're choosing anarchy. And we don't call it anarchy, we call it things like distribution and empowerment, but we love anarchy now, and we come to think it's sexy. We no longer believe government can do anything effectively. We don't see any real role for a public sector. We don't think corporations deserve to live either. We prefer them hollowed out and to the greatest extent possible, devoid of human beings. We don't make policy, we just make gestures. We prefer gestures to actual politics. In 1996, we like our politics one phosphor dot thick. The Communications Decency Act was a gesture. It's supposed to make Ralph Reed believe that the authorities are exerting control in an important new realm of modern life. To anyone with a grasp of reality, it demonstrates entirely the opposite. It's law that would provoke total chaos if anyone took it seriously. It's unenforceable, unconstitutional, a cosmetic sop to reactionaries, a hoax. It's the informational equivalent of creationism. The CDA is not the well-considered legislative act of the government of a major power seriously attempting to improve the lives of its citizenry. It's an act of charlatanry by distracted amateurs. You know, I think a lot of us have expected draconian reactions to the spectacular growth of the internet, and some of us may have even expected enlightened and helpful reactions, but not many of us really expected ridiculous and embarrassing reactions. You know, another useful way to envision the future is to think by historical analogy. And where can we find a good analogy for irresponsible political behavior by a continental superpower that is slowly but thoroughly losing its grip? Well, the analogy is perestroika, radical restructuring toward a new world order which, in point of fact, never actually arrives. The disorder is the new world order. And when I say anarchy, I don't mean annihilation or Armageddon or violent civil war. It's just a process of disintegration. It's very visible in that endless process of hollowing out and destructuring that has slowly reduced the world's other superpower into a farcical, yet murderous, comic opera of mafia bankers and a ragged army of starving drunks. That's what reality is in Russia today. Can't happen here, not our kind of problem. Don't think so. The people we put in control of American government are not responding to pragmatic reality. The right are self-blinded zealots, and the left simply cannot get a grip. Consider some actual threats to American civilization: the LA riots, terrorism from the militia ultra-right, growing class polarization, widening gaps in income, decline in life expectancy. If we were trying to stretch a bit, we might even talk about carbon dioxide buildup, maybe, or these weird spells of weather we seem to be having. Now tell me what anybody in the government is doing to frankly confront these problems. We'd rather fuss about school uniforms and abortion. We're quite severely detached from reality now. Maybe nowhere more than in the severely unreal virtualities of cyberspace. Cyberspace policy, it's cyberspace politics with its weird obsessions, its ridiculous bogus phantoms such as pornography and the unspeakable earth-shattering menace of crypto, all this ritualized clucking over sideshows and around us the most basic structures of the 20th century are visibly coming apart And nothing whatsoever is taking the place of the dissolving structure. We're careening headlong into this vast, buzzing, automated global disorder of prosperity without jobs, skills without careers, instant millionaires and shattered corporate research labs, all presided over by a dazed and deeply reactionary Congress that shamefully shirks its constitutional obligations and enters the 21st century by assassinating its own Office of Technology Assessment. We're heading for a situation very much like Russia's, an endless, raucous, jarring, corrupt casino economy where governments launch endless series of hollow edicts that encounter no resistance at all from the fabric of reality. Sleepwalking toward a weird dream of a digital Belle Epoque where we never have to take responsibility for anything, where we're all reduced to the status of awestruck children in a world where machinery takes the role of the adults, where the invisible hands of the market and technological determinism have seized the steering wheel of the jam-packed global bus. And you know, maybe the situation wouldn't be so bad. It does have its brighter aspects. Maybe we've just been fooling ourselves during all these centuries of civilization. Maybe we human beings never had any real control over our own destinies and what happens to us. Maybe we've always been puppets of contingency. Me, I'm a freelance writer by trade. I'm quite at home in a world where even oil companies want to act like Hollywood. As someone who was whining and moaning not so long ago about the menace of big business for years, it would be kind of hypocritical of me if I didn't say I rather enjoy watching them tear themselves apart. And the world we're inhabiting today is certainly very colorful and intensely interesting. Really, it makes a great science fiction novel. But there's a basic problem when there's no one human at the wheel. I question whether any of us really believe in our heart of hearts that we can get away with this kind of abdication over the longer term. Behind our carefree enjoyment of the technological sublime is a grave and terrible fear, a feel that all of us are secretly awaiting some inevitable misstep, some spasm, some crash, some digital atrocity that will be so swift and terrible and final that it will finally force us to wake up and act. You know, we CFP types, we're always talking about this. We're always conjuring up these looming specters of disaster just over the horizon. You know, I can remember when we used to chatter in terror about teenage boys who could start World War III from a payphone. And now we seem to believe that the internet is full of people who want to rape the teenage boys. The threats go in and out of style, and the villains and the victims change identities, but the hysteria is always a given. Now, if we, by some minor miracle, actually had a coherent vision, if we knew where we were going and what we wanted when we got there, we probably wouldn't have to conjure up these specters. If we had a better carrot, you see, something to go toward, we might not need quite so many whips. If we had a place for people to go, we wouldn't have to lock up quite so many of them. And if we knew where the United States wanted to take the world, we wouldn't have to build wars and multiply armies against our closest neighbors. We wouldn't have to pitchfork people out of our shrinking enclaves of privilege, because we'd have an actual use for people. We'd have a future. Now, gizmos we've got, ladies and gentlemen, and they're really nice. But where is our future? You want me to tell you? I'm a novelist. You tell me. I'm serious. That's not a counsel of despair. Just go ahead. Tell me. And I know that's an odd demand, a demand to be given a future. But we're not going to get the answer from our politicians or our lawmakers. They truly do not have a clue. They have proved that repeatedly. You may not have an answer yourself, but you have a lot of the clues. I don't think there's a room full of people anywhere in the world who are better equipped to give the world a future. So if you come up with something, send email. Thank you very much.
What time is it by your watch there, Susan? That's it. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I declare this conference over. If necessary, we'll have you removed by force. It's been wonderful. Thank you so much.